Hello and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today we're reading from vanityfair.com. There's a lot of current events. We're checking in on the Olympics and other things that have been in the news lately. Not so much in the politics section, so this is going to be more of an eclectic grouping of articles to share with you this week. We are starting with a memoriam. James Vanderbeek, the star of Dawson's Creek, dies at 48. The actor became a millennial heartthrob in his 20s thanks to the WB teen drama and spent decades processing his sudden onslaught of fame. This is by Julie Miller on February 11th. James Vanderbeek, the Dawson's Creek star who enraptured a generation of young women as the titular character on the 90s teen drama, died on Wednesday after a three-year-long battle with stage 3 colorectal cancer. He was 48. Vanderbeek's wife, Kimberly Vanderbeek, announced the news on Instagram. "Our beloved James David Vanderbeek passed peacefully this morning," Kimberly wrote. "He met his final days with courage, faith, and grace. There is much to share regarding his wishes, love for humanity, and the sacredness of time. Those days will come. For now, we ask for peaceful privacy as we grieve our loving husband, father, son, brother, and friend." In 2023, the actor revealed that he had been diagnosed with stage 3 colorectal cancer. In the time since, Vanderbeek spoke publicly about his health battle and how it caused him to reevaluate his personal life with wife Kimberly and their 6 children, Olivia, Joshua, Annabelle, Amelia, Gwendolyn, and Jeremiah, who range from ages 15 to 4. "It has been the hardest year of my life," Vanderbeek said in a March 2025 video on Instagram to celebrate his 48th birthday. "When I was younger, I used to define myself as an actor, which was never really all that fulfilling. Then I became a husband, and that was much better. And then I became a father, and that was the ultimate. I could define myself as a loving, capable, strong, supportive husband and father and provider. Then this year, I had to look my own mortality in the eye. I had to come nose to nose with death, and all of those definitions I cared so deeply about were stripped from me." Unable to physically provide for his wife and children, he said he had come to a different conclusion about himself. "I am worthy of God's love simply because I exist." He acknowledged that the spirituality of the comet might turn some people off, so he shared a censored version of his hard-fought wisdom with his followers. "You are worthy of love because you are." A Connecticut native who discovered acting as a teenager, Vanderbeek was cast as Dawson Leary, the introspective high school student ensnared in 6 seasons worth of love triangles at the age of 20. The shift from unknown to heartthrob happened practically overnight, with women and teenagers mobbing him at malls just 2 weeks after he signed his first autograph. In the decades that followed, Vanderbeek spoke about his difficulty processing the sudden onslaught of attention. "My reaction to fame was to run away from it," the actor told ABC in 2020. "I didn't know what to do with recognizability." Even the show's theme song, Paula Cole's I Don't Wanna Wait, seemed to have traumatized him. "If I was at karaoke and it started playing, there's a part of me, and I'm a fucking grown-ass man with 4 kids, that still wants to go hide under the table," Vanderbeek told The Guardian in 2017. "I was at a pharmacy in Philadelphia, and it came on, and I immediately went into a weird panic. I think it's tied to the pandemonium that accompanied that, for which there was no off button. Walking around at that time was very tricky because one autograph could turn into a mob scene. So I walked around in fear of teenage girls." Dawson's Creek, which debuted on the now-extinct channel, WB, and aired weekly before the deluge of streaming options, hit a cultural nerve with a generation of millennials. "I think if people want a perfect snapshot of what it was like to come of age in the 90s and be a young person in that moment, Dawson's will always be a time capsule of that," said Greg Berlanti, a former showrunner, in a 2018 interview with Entertainment Weekly. After Dawson's Creek ended in 2003, Vanderbeek had trouble shedding the character that Fatherly once called the patron saint of pouty boys. Before that, the actor took his charms to the big screen, starring in the 1999 coming-of-age drama Varsity Blues. While filming the movie, Vanderbeek said he asked his co-star, John Voight, how he dealt with the constant attention and autograph seeking. He said, "You have such a gift, and that is the gift of being able to make somebody very happy by doing something very simple. All you have to do is sign that paper, give them a little bit of time, look at them, talk to them, and you'll make them happy. What a gift that is." And that made it click for me. Roger Avery, who directed Vanderbeek in 2002's The Rules of Attraction, spoke about what made the then 20-something actor so special. He has something that a lot of other actors didn't have, a built-in likability, kind of a puppy dog charisma. Vanderbeek reinvented his career in the 2010s by, ironically, leaning into the character he couldn't shake. After a clip of Dawson ugly crying on the show went viral, the actor recreated it for a Funny or Die video and starred as an exaggerated version of himself on the TV comedy Don't Trust the Bee in Apartment 23. "It turns out that James Vanderbeek is funny," wrote the New York Times in 2017. "The fun of having a set of expectations is subverting them," he told the outlet. He had tried to escape the character to no avail, so part of the meta thing was just running toward it and playing with it. Vanderbeek collected a diverse resume, dabbling in crime procedurals, Law & Order, Criminal Minds, CSI, Cyber. Reality competition series, Dancing with the Stars, where he was a semifinalist, and the Ryan Murphy-verse, Pose. 2 years ago, the same year he was diagnosed with cancer, Vanderbeek began coming around to the idea of his Dawson's Creek fame. It seemed that the public's affection, which is some seemed so overwhelming in his younger years, was a welcome source of support. "The truth is, I didn't know what to do with fame for the longest time, because it took me a while to realize it wasn't actually about me," Vanderbeek wrote on Instagram to celebrate the show's 25th anniversary. "While I used to feel like it created a weird separation from people, now I feel like it connects me in a way I really appreciate." In September, Vanderbeek was forced to sit out a much-anticipated reunion of Dawson's Creek because of health issues. The event, held in New York's Richards Rogers Theater, was organized by his series co-star Michelle Williams as a tribute to him and a benefit to cancer awareness. Co-stars Williams, Katie Holmes, and Joshua Jackson recreated the pilot episode of the series, with Lin-Manuel Miranda filling in as Dawson. "Despite every effort, I won't get to be there," a frail-looking Vanderbeek told audience members during a pre-taped message. "I won't get to stand on that stage and thank every soul in the theater for showing up for me and against cancer when I needed it most." His wife and six children appeared at the event in his place, with two of his daughters helping sing the show's theme song on stage. In a social media post afterwards, Holmes wrote, "James, you got this. We got you. To everyone who supported us from the beginning and who continue to support James and his beautiful family, we thank you." Vanderbeek, meanwhile, had ended his Instagram post about the Dawson's Creek 25th anniversary by writing, "Thank you to everyone I've encountered as a result of this strange, wild rocket ship ride." We are going next to a news story that is very close to home for us. At Nancy Guthrie's home, a surreal scene of chaos and camaraderie. A reporter with a local news affiliate tells Vanity Fair that the case is pretty bizarre. This is by Casey Wickman on February 14th. Everyone's heard no news is good news, at least once in their lives, the if it ain't broke of sitting tight and maintaining the status quo. In Tucson, where the Pima County Sheriff's Department and the FBI are working in joint investigation that is stretched out nearly 2 weeks in an effort to uncover the whereabouts of Nancy Guthrie, the adage is about as far from true as it can be. Nancy, the 84-year-old mother of Today co-anchor Savannah Guthrie, was reported missing on Sunday, January 31st, after she didn't show up for standing plans to watch a live-streamed church service with a friend that morning. She's medically fragile, dependent on daily medication, and uses a hearing aid as well as a pacemaker. Local media outlets, as well as TMZ, have reported receiving notes with ransom demands for Nancy's return, and the Guthrie family has released several videos pleading with the public for information in the case and with Nancy's presumed captor for proof of life, further instructions, anything. There's been plenty of chatter, but not news. The PCSD hasn't held a briefing for the media since February 5th, when the FBI announced a $50,000 reward for information in the case, and Sheriff Chris Nanos all but wagged his finger while answering a journalist's question about the crime scene of Nancy's house being cleared and released back to the family, only to have tape go back up days later so the FBI could have their own look around. "It's Monday morning quarterbacking," Nano said. "I do it all the time, so you can do that for me. I'll take that hit." And to a question about whether possible evidence could have been contaminated, that's a later problem. I'll let the courts worry about that. Even a widely reported SWAT action at a residence near Guthrie's home Friday night was accompanied by little context. Media assembled at a designated point, expecting an update, but were told hours later that there would be no formal statement. Because this is a joint investigation at the request of the FBI, no additional information is currently available, the PCSD said via X. According to CNN, no suspects were detained in the law enforcement swarm, which blocked a road about 2 miles from the primary scene. Day after day, for almost 2 weeks, a growing number of people, media professionals and self-appointed citizen investigators alike, have flocked to Nancy's home in the Catalina foothills outside Tucson, where information comes out in drips and drabs. Sudden flurries of activity erupt and then abruptly die out, and that crime scene tape goes up and down again and again. Consider that through the FBI on Tuesday released several still shots and clips of a person approaching Nancy's door, recovered from home surveillance cameras. Law enforcement continues to decline to confirm or deny that there were signs of forced entry to the home. "I have no clue where that comes from," Nano said in that news conference. "We're not discussing that at all." In the same media briefing, he seems to shut down hope that any footage would be recovered, saying, "The tech company that we sent that camera off to, they've run out of ways to recover any video. Because Nancy didn't have an active subscription, the footage wasn't saved." Then those images were released on February 10th, along with the joint statement from law enforcement citing residual data on back-end servers that uncovered these previously inaccessible new images showing an armed individual appearing to have tampered with the camera at Nancy Guthrie's front door the morning of her disappearance. What made that change possible? They're not saying. Ford Hatchett, a journalist with Phoenix's ABC 15, arrived at Nancy's house on Monday, February 1st, the morning after her disappearance, and has been back and forth between Phoenix and Tucson several times in the days since. He tells Vanity Fair that while he's covered crime stories before, this particular case has been pretty bizarre. "There's camaraderie in that cluster of media, which has grown exponentially since that first Monday he showed up, where journalists get to know one another and save each other's parking spots or go in on lunch, while knowing that they're in competition with each other for the same story. They talk to each other and agree that the lack of firm leads and ever-changing search parameters and requests is unusual. This one in particular, it feels like every time we feel like we have a good handle on it, there's a new twist or a turn that catches us all off guard," he says. Hatchett talked to the man who was detained by authorities earlier this week and then released, only identified as Carlos. Law enforcement didn't disclose why they stopped him, nor why they released him, not to the public, nor to Carlos, evidently. Nanos told outlets that officers have found quite a number of gloves, but not whether any of them seemed significant. "We don't even know the true value of these gloves," he said. "Neither do we." The FBI upped its reward for information to $100,000 and nosed around a septic tank as internet sleuths went wild. Despite the ceaseless attention on Nancy's house, multiple delivery drivers, Flowers, Pizza, Amazon, have been able to walk right up to the same front stoop that law enforcement found drops of Nancy's blood splattered in recent days. Hatchett and other journalists were also allowed to get close to the house in the early days after the sheriff's department opened the scene, but before they closed it again. "I think almost everybody at least walked up," Hatchett says. "At least everybody wanted to get their own eyes on it." There's no requirement for media accreditation outside Guthrie's home, where a mix of local, national, international, and interested citizens, who may have nothing more than just a phone and a tripod, as he describes it, jostle for space on a scene that manages to be simultaneously scrutinized and somehow lax. "We saw an Amazon delivery driver walk right up to the front door," he says. "We saw the pizza delivery being able to go right up to the front door. When I say this case is bizarre, those are just things I haven't seen in any other scene." It wasn't until Thursday, February 12th, that law enforcement put up a white tent in front of the central hub of the home, 12 days after so many accessed it for their own purposes. For the first time since the case began, the front door at the center of the mystery was inaccessible. "It's almost hard to believe your eyes," Hatchett said. "You don't blame the delivery drivers, but it's interesting for this story that is all-consuming for all of us that sit here at the scene to see some people arrive and have no idea what's going on. It's kind of a reminder of what's going on in the real world, too, that not everyone's quite as obsessed with this as we are." We are moving now to the Olympics. Love, betrayal, and Taylor Swift at the Milano Cortina 2026 Winter Olympics. From a proposal celebrated by Taylor Swift to an on-air confession of infidelity, the Milano Cortina 2026 Winter Olympics isn't just a sporting event, it's a soap opera. This is by Roberta Mercury on February 14th. Love is creeping up on sports as the star of the Milan Cortina 2026 Winter Olympics. Between the proposals, kisses, and admissions of romantic betrayal, it seems only fitting that the games were held over Valentine's Day, rivaling Wuthering Heights as the soapiest entertainment to enjoy this long holiday weekend. The most romantic story to date features gold medalist Breezy Johnson. 4 days after her Olympic triumph, the American downhill skier fell during the Super G run in Cortina d'Ampezzo on Thursday, but she still found joy at the finish line. Her fiancé, Connor Watkins, was there, on bended knee with a ring in his hand. Visibly excited, Johnson accepted his proposal, which was accompanied with an allusion to Taylor Swift's song, The Alchemy. On hearing the news, the famous singer congratulated the couple on Instagram with another quote from the song. Romance comes in many forms, as illustrated by the scene when Jutta Leerdam broke an Olympic record and took home the gold medal in the women's 1,000-meter speed skating event. Leerdam's boyfriend, controversial conservative influencer Jake Paul, appeared to cry frantically as he watched her performance. How beautiful to see such an open expression of sensitivity from the boxer. Paul was not the only person at the Olympics expressing complicated emotions. Immediately after winning the bronze medal in the biathlon, Sturla Holm Lagrid confessed in tears that he had cheated on his girlfriend. 6 months ago, I met the love of my life, the most extraordinary person in the world. But 3 months ago, I made the biggest mistake of my life and was unfaithful to her, were his words when translated. In a text message to a Norwegian newspaper, his former partner dismissed his words. "I did not choose to be put in this position. It is painful to find myself in it. It is difficult to forgive," she wrote, "especially a betrayal admitted on television." These Winter Olympics are also the opportunity for established couples to publicly display their ongoing romance. Many athletes are longtime partners in life and on the ice, such as skaters Marco Fabbri and Charlene Guinard. Romantically linked even before they became partners on the rink in 2010, the fires of their love still burn brightly. A few days ago, after winning bronze in the figure skating team event, the two exchanged a kiss that captivated the entire arena. The moment was an inspiration for other couples at the 2026 Winter Olympics, including Mila Rudd-Wrighton and Nikolai Mayerov, who confirmed their relationship more than a year ago, and Madison Chalk and Evan Bates, the free dance winners who have been married since 2024. In mixed doubles curling, Canadians Jocelyn Peterman and Brett Gallant began as teammates, but their sporting partnership evolved into a romantic relationship. In 2023, the couple celebrated the birth of their first child. But sometimes relationships evolve in the other direction. Figure skaters Sarah Conti and Niccolò Macchi broke up in 2023, but they continue to skate together, even clinching a bronze medal in the team event. "When a love breaks up, often the artistic couple also breaks up," Conti said in an interview. "I think we should be proud because we held on and managed to find the strength to get back together on the track and resume pursuing our goals, even with the help of a psychologist." Machi says that working through the breakup was worth it in the long run. "When we broke off our relationship, rags flew on the track. Now instead, we're bound by a beautiful friendship," he said. Conti will even attend Masi to fiancé Vanessa Dia Vendova later this year with a plan to attend on the arm of her new date, ice dancer Tim Deek. Our next article is from the business section. The CEOs of Kalshi and Polymarket are betting on the most hated experiment in business. Prediction markets entice enterprising nerds to make and lose fortunes by wagering on everything from politics to the weather. Here's why they're unstoppable and only getting more powerful. This is by Zoe Bernard on February 11th. Jack DeShane was doing serious volume on the Pope market. DeShane is 25 years old and by his own account knows next to nothing about the papal conclave. Yet in May 2025, as cardinals locked themselves inside the Sistine Chapel to decide who would inherit the throne of St. Peter after the death of Pope Francis, DeShane was on a website called Kalshi, buying and selling contracts worth some $30,000 on the various outcomes of who might win the papacy. These odds were driven less by Vatican intrigue than by straightforward mathematical calculation. For most of the conclave, the Chicago guy, the future Pope Leo XIV, was trading between like 1 and 5 cents, says DeShane. To predict the odds of various cardinals becoming pope, DeShane was not even using particularly fancy math, he tells me. This is the math you can find on Wikipedia. DeShane has become so consumed by papal market making that he was falling behind on his studies at Princeton, where he was writing his thesis on game theory. Still, it seemed financially irresponsible to devote any time at all to classwork, given that DeShane could net some $10,000 on the Pope market alone in a single week. In a single year on Kalshi, DeShane estimates he's made $1.5 million. I met DeShane in the summer of 2025 at a Kalshi happy hour held at a dimly lit pub in Greenwich Village. The prediction market startup, newly flush with venture cash, had invited its most active users, or as one organizer kept calling them, all the top dorks, to swap trading tips over beer and sliders. These were dressed-down guys in t-shirts, mostly in their early 20s, who were earning fortunes on a marketplace that, until recently, had existed in a legal gray zone. Many were making thousands a week speculating on highly specific fixations, whether the temperature would tick up by a single degree in Colorado next weekend, who would win the Coney Island hot dog eating contest, the gender of celebrity babies. It may sound silly, but many of the hardcore nerds at the center of this movement saw something larger taking shape, an experiment in collective intelligence with the potential to upend not only Wall Street, but the inner workings of American democracy. Yet only one person there mentioned the dirty word that everyone else had so carefully avoided. A little guy in the corner with especially large teeth, a thick Eastern European accent, and a few sparse hairs attempting to cloak his balding forehead. He was swirling a glass of ice and cryptically dodging my basic questions. For instance, what his name was. I'd been riffing about prediction markets with him when he leaned in close, his mouth full of cheeseburger. "You're writing about this, but you have no idea what this meeting is, do you?" "What is it?" I asked, leaning back to avoid his spittle. "This," he said, taking in the barroom of traders, "is just the latest Gamblers Anonymous meeting." Back in 2016, just about everyone on Wall Street wanted exposure to two things, Trump winning the election and Brexit. At the time, Tariq Mansour, an MIT grad with a perpetual 5 o'clock shadow, was working as an analyst at Goldman Sachs and creating bundles of stock options that attempted to predict what might happen if Trump won or Brexit passed. This, as it turned out, was the financial equivalent of reading tea leaves through a Bloomberg terminal. The clumsiness of this exercise sparked Mansour to wonder, what if we create a financial market that prices questions about the future the same way you price a stock? Not long after, Mansour began sketching out an idea for a new kind of financial market, a cleaner, more direct version of the one he'd been simulating inside Goldman. It would do what markets, at their best, have always done, distill collective belief into a price. If it worked, Mansour reasoned that it stood to become the most consequential market ever built, because it would be concerned with questions that preoccupy everyone. The stock market prices corporate futures. Mansour wanted to build a market that priced the future itself. The result was Kalshi, a company he launched in early July 2021, with his co-founder, Brazilian-born fellow MIT grad and former ballerina, Luana Lopez Lara, a marketplace that would make truth tradable. There was, however, one minor obstacle. The kind of market Kalshi wanted to build was illegal, at least according to the U.S. Commodity Futures Trading Commission. So Mansour and Lopez Lara did what any enterprising startup founders might do, they sued the federal government. Thus began a slog of bureaucratic skirmishes that unfolded over the course of 3 years. The decisive blow came in October 2024, when Kalshi won the right to host an election market weeks before the nation's next presidential vote. This development, more than any other, vaulted prediction markets into the national conversation, bringing in more than $100 million in wagers. On Polymarket, another prediction market, and Kalshi's crypto-based competitor, traders put up a staggering $3.2 billion in wagers. Suddenly, what had seemed like a niche experiment was becoming a financial reality. Since then, the bets have kept on coming. Kalshi currently hosts more than 2,000 markets, ranging from headline events to the absurdly specific. The big idea, according to Mansour, is that these markets give us the ability to see the future more clearly. They are a mechanism for us to get a little bit smarter, he says. Imagine a world where, if we're debating on whether climate change is real, and you're screaming, no, it's absolutely not real, and I'm screaming, climate change is 100% real, you're full of shit. There's a market where people have real money on the line saying there's a 70% chance that next year is going to be hotter than this year. And we have this objective, unbiased, filtered source of truth for what the future holds. The reason these markets are so useful to society is because people have skin in the game. In many ways, these markets are nothing new. Americans have been betting on election outcomes as far back as the Lincoln era. In the 1930s, political wagers sometimes outpaced trading in stocks and bonds. Voting has always been a sort of gaming like checkers or backgammon, Henry David Thoreau wrote in 1849, and betting naturally accompanies it. Markets also tend to be good at prediction. An election market created by three economists at the University of Iowa in 1988 beats the polls in at least three elections, and on Wall Street, futures markets have proved very good at forecasting. Considering this brief history, it's somewhat curious that prediction markets haven't gained wider traction. Other examples of futures markets, like the Hollywood Stock Exchange, launched in 1996 to let traders wager on box office results, and Predictit, a forecasting site founded in 2014, have repeatedly faced pushback from both institutions and regulators. But today's prediction market boom seems destined to last for two reasons. The first is that these markets have found unusually warm support in Washington under the second Trump administration, where they are treated like the hottest new civic innovation project. Devin Nunes, a former congressman and current CEO of Trump Media and Technology Group, has described them as tools that empower everyday Americans to harness the wisdom of the crowd. Donald Trump Jr. serves as a special advisor to both Kalshi and Polymarket. And in October, Truth Social announced plans to launch a prediction market of its own called Truth Predict. I'm going to pause here to remind you that you're listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. We're in the middle of an article about prediction futures predictions. The second reason is subtler. Prediction markets are gaining momentum in an era when experts have burned through their authority. Institutional knowledge is almost universally scorned, and shared reality is splintering into an algorithmic hall of mirrors. The pollsters miss the polls, the networks can't agree on the facts, and Trump's government is backpedaling on 2 centuries' worth of scientific consensus. Perhaps these problems can be solved by putting a price on truth and turning it into a commodity. It's a very elegant, very free market-based approach, says Mansour. We're giving a financial incentive, rewarding people that have valuable information for society to bring it into the marketplace. Already, these markets are viewed as a convincing barometer for truth. Saul Munn, a 22-year-old who studies philosophy at Berkeley and hosts forecasting events at universities, tells me that when he wants to know what's going on in the world, he's more likely to check the odds on Kalshi than watch CNN. The traders make a lot of money from being right, he says. One guy is incentivized to get clicks. The other guy is incentivized to make money. Never mind that prediction markets often rely on reporting from CNN to settle their bets. While boosters promise tidy yes or no wagers, in practice, traders sometimes spend days parsing ambiguous contracts in Kalshi's and Polymarket's Discord servers. Perhaps the most famous example of this was a bet on Polymarket that asked whether Volodymyr Zelensky would wear a suit by a certain date. When the Ukrainian president stepped out in a tailored-looking outfit, traders tore one another apart, debating the definition of the word suit. The market, which ultimately determined its outcome through what the company described as credible reporting, resolved to no, to no one's lasting satisfaction. Despite all the ambiguity, prediction markets' biggest backers, Silicon Valley venture capitalists, remain undeterred. It used to be that the medium was the message. In Silicon Valley, the line has been updated. The markets are the message, says one venture communications executive. That gospel has set off a frenzy. Since the election, so many people have started building prediction markets, says Ered, an investor based in Portugal. Some of these people are founders whose products didn't catch on, and so they pivoted to prediction. It's like dozens and dozens and dozens. Like, really, a lot, and it's happening. It's still happening. Ered, too, has caught the bug. Earlier this year, he left his job as a venture capitalist to start his own prediction market called Lightcone Labs. According to prototypes I've seen and conversations I've had with dozens of traders and founders, the future of those markets looks something like this. Every news story will come with a trade button beside it. Podcasts will let listeners bet live as the host talk. NFL broadcasts will flash odds on whether the next pass will be caught. Even reality dating shows will come with tickets predicting which couples are most likely to find love. In other words, every conviction will have a price. Boosters believe prediction markets could also double as a kind of idiosyncratic insurance for an increasingly unstable world. If you booked a beach vacation in Florida, for instance, and worried a hurricane might ruin it, you could hedge the risk by betting on the storm and recouping your losses on the weather market. If traditional insurers won't touch your California home, you could still place a sizable wager on the odds of a wildfire creeping into your neighborhood. This is going to be as big as equity markets, commodity markets, derivative markets, says Tony Gamayel, who has worked at both Kalshi and Polymarket. I think of them as opinion markets. Everybody has an opinion on something. The issue with both Kalshi and Polymarket, Gamayel says, is that they generate their own markets, built around news cycles, elections, sporting events, and the occasional trader suggestion. Gamayel plans to solve for this by, yes, building his own prediction market called the Clearing Company, which gives anyone the ability to create any kind of market they can imagine. According to Gamayel, the Clearing Company will be far better than any kind of futures markets that currently exist on Wall Street. Years ago, Gamayel met a guy in Seattle who got so good at modeling the weather that he now wins 95% of weather markets. To do so, he built a bespoke network of weather stations. Good luck to somebody at Citadel who wants to trade against this guy because he will beat them, Gamayel says. This, to me, is the cool thing about prediction markets. Everyone has an area of deep expertise, something that they are way more interested in than somebody on Wall Street ever would be, and it's just really hard to compete against that. The prediction market boom has already cracked open a strange new world of opportunity that rewards obsession, precision, and niche expertise. In the months I reported this story, I met a stay-at-home mom in Alabama who studied meteorology in college and made $20,000 betting on 1- and 2-degree temperature swings in Denver. Today, she's known as Weather Shannon and works as an operations specialist for Kalshi. I met young men in their early 20s who quit their jobs as Wall Street quants to create market-making firms. Why would you work at Goldman when you can work at Kalshi? Asked a communications advisor who works with the company. This is the next generation of finance. But the most successful of all was a former poker player based in Las Vegas who tells me he's cleared $2.8 million this year betting on politics. His strategy involves watching C-SPAN 16 hours a day. We are entering a brave new world in which every headline, celebrity scandal, and twist of global politics can, will, be bought, sold, and wagered on. The downstream effects are already well on their way. In December, Kalshi struck a deal with CNN and CNBC to broadcast live tickers on air, turning the news into a real-time market with the Kalshi logo attached. In January, the Golden Globes featured a Polymarket integration, with announcers frequently mentioning the odds of various races as a ticker flashed on screen. The cultural shift is so seismic that the venture firm Andreessen Horowitz believes it is poised to become the single organizing principle of the next era. Prediction is now the entire game, writes the firm's editor-at-large, Alex Danko, in a company blog post. It's the movement and meta-aesthetic that defines our main branch of society going forward. Prediction is as significant a concept as modernism and postmodernism. It's the defining reframe of our generation, and we'd better understand it. The most zealous supporters envision prediction markets as a new framework for governing. In Silicon Valley, this idea is having a moment thanks to Robin Hanson, a prickly economist who years ago introduced the concept of futarchy, a system that would route government decisions through the cool logic of betting markets. In a paper that he first released in 2000, Hanson laid out a blueprint for government that passes laws only when markets predict they will increase national welfare. The major problem of modern government, he argues, is that countries and democracies fail largely by not aggregating available information. One of the first people to mention the idea of futarchy to me is a pseudonymous programmer in San Francisco who goes only by the name Profit, and a three is the E in Profit. He is a self-described super anon crypto type. When he does make public appearances, he typically uses a voice distorter and wears a bronze cyborgian mask with two glowing blue eyes. Lately, he's slightly relaxed the anonymity. On the day we speak over the phone, he's not using a voice distorter. He sounds exactly how I expected him to, like a nerdy white guy in his late 20s or early 30s. About 3 years ago, Profit launched a company called Meta DAO, which he describes as civilization's first futarchy. The company relies on markets to reach all of its key decisions, like whether it should seek outside investment. Like other futarchy evangelists, Profit believes that the markets are a sleek, superior upgrade to the clunky machinery of government. This is not democracy, he says. It's a new thing. It's better. While democracy has been an improvement on other forms of governing, it's still pretty structurally flawed, Profit continues, and markets don't have that problem, right? People that work in markets know all these intricate, fine-grained details about the companies they're analyzing because they can make money by having that information. Profit's vision might sound fringe, but it's closer to the center of power than it appears. It's the same logic that animates one of the industry's rising stars, Shane Copeland, the curly-haired founder of Polymarket, who has retained a kind of industry bad boy allure ever since federal agents raided his apartment after Polymarket correctly called the presidential race in November 2024. No legal action was taken against Copeland or Polymarket. Futarchy is one of my favorite ideas that exists, Copeland tells me over a Zoom call last summer. It's a difficult sell, but the idea of using markets to aid decision-making in pursuit of optimizing for some final variable that is a metric that represents what people want or what's good for the body that's being governed is super exciting. When I ask if he thinks we're on a path to futarchy becoming a tool of governance, he doesn't hesitate. I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing if I didn't think it were. The seduction of precision prediction markets as creating a gleaming world through pooled information and the cold clarity of bets. This vision posits that we all might be better off in a meritocratic republic of sharpshooters, placing elegant little wagers on the truths that will supposedly steer us toward a greater public good. The reality is more human and a lot stupider. These markets are kind of janky, John Oberlander, who trades on Kalshi, tells me. Aside from a bunch of markets that aren't liquid, they are the usual teething pains of fast-growing startups, glitchy sites, outages, weird edge case complaints that happen when you build something that was barely legal a few years ago. Then there are the complaints that cut directly against the high-minded mission prediction markets like to project. For all the talk of surfacing truth and harnessing collective intelligence, most of the volume on these sites come from one of the oldest forms of gambling there is, sports betting. Nearly 90% of volume on prediction markets come directly from sports contracts, and the sector has grown quickest in states that prohibit it, thanks to a convenient regulatory workaround. The cynical take is, wow, they came up with a word prediction markets to now offer gambling for the 50 states who didn't really sign up for this, says Oberlander. They have to do all sorts of theatrics to get the regulation and the tax treatment they want, but everyone who's invested in it can see what's happening here. When I asked Mansoor if Kalshi might be just be a more polished spin on gambling, he says that he disagrees with the question's premise. We don't think it's gambling, he says. We just don't. And in the places where it really does look like gambling, what Kalshi provides is actually an ethical upgrade, according to Mansoor. On sports books, users bet against the house. On Kalshi, they bet against each other. Sure, Kalshi skims a transaction fee off the top of any trade, but we don't have any incentive for you to lose money, he says. Whether regulators buy that argument is another question. In late November, Kalshi was hit with a class action lawsuit accusing the company of running misleading, unlicensed sports gambling. Then again, what are financial markets if not nation-size gambles dressed up in spreadsheets? For believers like Gamal, prediction markets aren't a deviation so much as a cleaner, smarter upgrade. Derivatives, in my mind, is just a fancy word for gambling, says Gamal. You know, a lot of what Wall Street is doing is a lot closer to betting than I think the average American realizes. Our next article, Jeffrey Epstein's quarter zip and the rise of a fringe fashion obsession. The sweatshirt, a hallmark to Epstein's sociopathic insouciance, can now be purchased from an array of eBay and Etsy entrepreneurs. Nick Fuentes' web store or a dedicated fan site. This is by Dan Adler on February 14th. I was swiping through Instagram stories last week when I was served an eBay ad for a very familiar sweatshirt. Of all the accoutrement of the life and crimes of Jeffrey Epstein, a 2005 image showing him wearing a navy monogrammed quarter zip and a slight characteristic smirk has acquired an endless digital footprint and a discomforting resonance. With the Epstein story approaching the 10-year mark as a global preoccupation, this nth phase of the intrigue, largely prompted by fallout from the Department of Justice's July proclamation that there were no further criminal charges in the works, has spawned a potent cottage industry. One can now purchase an Epstein quarter zip, as it is invariably described, from an array of Etsy entrepreneurs. The white nationalist streamer Nick Fuentes' web store for $69.99, or EpsteinQuarterZip.com for $49, which promotes its wares to 129,000 Instagram followers with AI-generated images of Donald Trump and Bill Clinton sporting the titular apparel. Iconic merch is how leading right-leaning gaming streamer Asmongold recently described it. When Fuentes wore his riff on the sweatshirt with USA replacing JEE, the American flag on the sleeve is true to the original. For a third week running, one of the X accounts that faithfully tracks his commentary said the choice represented pure aura. The quarter zip, in this conception of Epstein's much scrutinized persona, amounts to a signifier of ease and insouciance. The late financier wore rumpled sweatshirts around the global elite, presumably because he could. In April 2019, a few months before his arrest on federal sex trafficking charges, Epstein arrived at the artist Andres Serrano's Greenwich Village home to have his portrait taken. He acted the way he always acted, Serrano told me in 2022, like a guy who didn't have a care in the world. If there's any stylistic through line in the immense tranche of emails released in the latest round of Epstein documents, it's that Epstein was similarly unbothered in his personal communications. He wrote to executives and public officials with little concern for spelling or syntax, and capitalization seemed anathema to him. The Epstein files, long held up in the public imagination as a kind of Rosetta Stone for the sins of the wealthy and connected, included documents showing how the FBI had found little evidence to conclude that Epstein was running a sex trafficking ring for other powerful men. They also fed the bottomless appetite for glimpses into Epstein's eccentricities and the corruption of the ruling class. Even if few of the wildest conspiracies found material support, its cultural impact only grew larger. The quarter zip took a life of its own in September when Restricted, a Miami luxury reseller that primarily stocks chrome hearts and accepts cryptocurrency as payment, claimed to be selling the genuine article straight from Mar-a-Lago, the shop wrote on Instagram. This piece is very controversial and iconic. A rumor spread that it was purchased by Ian Connor, the stylist affiliated with the artist formerly known as Kanye West and A$AP Rocky in the 2010s, and whose career was soon overshadowed by a series of sexual assault allegations that he has denied. Connor had commented on the post with a money bag emoji and indicated that he wanted to discuss the matter over direct message. The shop's owner told the Miami New Times that after fielding more than 5,000 inquiries, he sold it to a different, unnamed client, whom he described as famous. He was certain that the sweatshirt, which he purchased for $5,000 from another client and sold for $11,000, was authentic. The client who sold him the sweater, he added, was from the Palm Beach area where Epstein had a home and also showed me, like, some mail he had and medicine prescription bottles. While Epstein also had the quarter zip in white, the Epstein files revealed, too, that he sought to give such sweatshirts as gifts to Noam Chomsky's wife and Steve Bannon, among others. It was the navy one that he wore to a 2005 party for the launch of Radar magazine at Hotel QT in Manhattan. Epstein had invested in the publication along with Mort Zuckerman, then the owner of the New York Daily News. The venue was a short-lived addition to Hotelier Andre Balazs's portfolio, which includes the Chateau Marmont. The quarter-zip source image was shot by a photographer employed by Patrick McMullen, the longtime socialite chronicler. The Epstein quarter zip is most proudly claimed on the far right, with the founder of AF Post, a fledgling digital media outlet dedicated to an America First mission, recently touting his purchase after proclaiming that he wanted to be like Jeffrey Epstein, minus the other stuff. But it also speaks, like so many Epstein ephemera, to a time and a place. Interest in the overall saga has spanned the ideological spectrum, and it's also often reduced to an interest in status and its trappings, a sordid cosmopolitan frisson. The joke of the quarter zip is in its nihilism and its sense that Epstein demonstrated something elemental about the melee he traversed. There he was, standing atop all manner of social, political, and financial hierarchies, powered mostly by a sociopathic capacity for self-invention beyond Tom Ripley's wildest dreams, and wearing whatever he pleased as he did. In the telling of far-right writer Steve Saylor, this made the Brooklyn-born Epstein an outer boroughs working-class hustler who was basically Marty Supreme. For the young men shelling out for a cotton-blend piece of the tawdry mythos, there's perhaps a more immediate interpretation. The evil Epstein lived his life with near-unlimited financial excess and luxury and is now immortalized in internet culture forever via memeing. Andrew Tate wrote this month in a now-deleted post on X, "He beat you in every single metric." This will most likely be our last article, entitled, "Epstein's Ghost is Calling All the Shots in Trump's White House." Trump thought he'd cut ties with Jeffrey Epstein years ago, but the deceased financier's shadow lurks across an administration struggling to outrun its own history. This is by Tara Palmieri on February 12th. When Donald Trump is asked about Jeffrey Epstein, his answers reveal less than the noises he makes. The irritation, the discomfort, the barely contained rage. He bristles, he huffs, he snaps. You can feel it. Incredulity boiling into ire as the president confronts the expectation that he must answer for a pedophile. "Quiet, piggy," he snapped at a female Bloomberg reporter in November 2025, cutting her off as she began to ask, "If there's nothing incriminating in the files, sir, then why not?" A few days later, he attacked ABC's Mary Bruce, saying her crappy company should lose its FCC license after she asked about the files. "You're not credible as a reporter, so I've answered your question," he jabbed. "You should go and look at the Democrats who received money from Epstein." The president, who relishes causing offense, now takes offense at the ongoing intrusion from a ghost of his past. As he tells it, they were friends, sure, but for much longer, they were ex-friends, and that was Trump's decision. They were contemporaries of a kind in New York and Palm Beach, but Epstein was a criminal who did time in a county jail cell while Trump became president, and when criminality threatened to define him, he overcame dropped or resolved charges to return to the White House. Among their stark differences, the most obvious is this. One man is dead, the other is leader of the free world. Epstein, who died in 2019, should be old news. Trump should be more relevant than ever. Yet it doesn't seem that way, at least as far as the public is concerned. Epstein's shadow has darkened nearly every corner of Trump's first year back in office, from DOJ inertia and congressional paralysis to personnel decisions and sinking poll numbers. Inside the White House, the issue is treated less like unfinished business and more like radioactive waste, something to be managed, contained, and cleared away daily. And it has clearly rattled a president determined to shape the narrative of his legacy in what is ostensibly his final term. Trump has long said he kicked Epstein out of Mar-a-Lago in 2003 over a staffing dispute after Epstein continually stole people who worked for him. But reporting by the Wall Street Journal later found that Epstein was also barred after pressuring an 18-year-old spa employee for sex. And months before that story was published, the White House said Trump had expelled Epstein simply for being a creep. The Journal also identified several other Mar-a-Lago employees in Epstein's address book. And we know that Ghislaine Maxwell recruited Virginia Giuffre while she was working at the club's spa at just 16 years old, bringing her back to Epstein's house where she was sexually assaulted. However it began, the rupture has been framed as everything from a personnel squabble to a moral line in the sand. Still, it's hard not to notice how small all these explanations feel for something so consequential. Could the trajectory of a presidency and a major political party and perhaps modern American history itself really trace back to a parochial dispute at a Palm Beach club at the start of the century? This reporting, of course, says that's not quite right. What we can say for certain is that reality suggests Trump's version is incomplete, the facts darker and more complex. Giuffre's story is of special consequence to me. I first met her in 2019 and came to know her and her story well. In a saga that could feel like a chaos of abstraction, she was crystal clear. Her allegations were consistent and specific. Several years after Giuffre's recruitment, Trump and Epstein were locked in a quiet war over oceanfront real estate. In 2004, they competed for Maison Les Amitiés, a Palm Beach mansion that ultimately sold for $41 million. Trump won the bidding, but only after Epstein drove up the price. Trump later flipped the house to a Russian oligarch for $95 million, yet insiders have said Epstein's participation made the overpayment sting. For two men obsessed with dominance, money, and status, it was a public humiliation, especially for Trump, who is notoriously cheap and whose ego is tethered to crushing opponents in deals. White House Chief of Staff Susie Wiles told Vanity Fair that the Trump-Epstein friendship dated back to when they were young, single playboys together. The administration wants the Epstein connection framed as ancient history, something the president has long moved past and that the country should move on from, too. Whether or not that characterization is accurate, and no matter which account of their breakup comes closer to the truth, one thing still stands. The two men remained locked in association, and Epstein holds the upper hand. When he was alive, Epstein bragged about his access and insight, hinted at shared sins, and worked behind the scenes to humiliate Trump through journalists like Michael Wolff. Now, in death, Epstein has achieved something more enduring. He has hijacked Trump's presidency. Early in the Trump's first administration, a White House official explained his media strategy to me. The morning tweets, the racist provocations, the impossible policy threats were designed to whip the press into a frenzy. The goal was distraction. Get us to chase everything and accomplish nothing. Some might say it worked, but Epstein doesn't work like that. These crimes are too grave, the network too sprawling, the documents too voluminous and concrete. Trump's name appears tens of thousands of times across Epstein-related files. Roughly 3.5 million pages have already been released. Millions more remain under review or withheld by Trump's own Justice Department for reasons still unexplained. Trump's presidency has become about Epstein. For proof of this, look no further than the New York Times homepage, where the layout of coverage of the administration paints a clear picture of what matters. Epstein fallout comes first, before news about his official policies or his geopolitical maneuvers. Meanwhile, the files have fractured MAGA. To prevent their release, Trump pressured House leadership to avoid a vote on the Epstein Files Transparency Act. His myopic self-preservation was so intense that it helped trigger one of the longest government shutdowns in history. Marjorie Taylor Greene said Trump told her, "Releasing the documents would mean that my friends will get hurt," a phrase Trump often uses when he means to talk about himself. When survivors gathered on Capitol Hill in September to demand transparency, fighter jets roared overhead, drowning out their voices. The administration claimed it was unrelated, a ceremonial flyover for a fallen Polish airman. The timing was uncanny, but the symbolism was perfect. Then came Trump's exchange with CNN's Caitlin Collins. After being asked last Tuesday whether the Epstein files should be more transparent and what he would say to survivors unhappy with the redactions, Trump didn't offer empathy or accountability. He attacked the reporter. "I think it's really time for the country to get on to something else. Now that nothing came out about me," he said, refusing to acknowledge the crimes or the victims, other than it was a conspiracy against me, literally, by Epstein and other people. "Then, for good measure, you are the worst reporter. I don't think I've ever seen you smile." It was telling. Asked what he would say to people who feel they've been denied justice, Trump defaulted to grievance and misogyny. His fixation is exoneration, not truth. The Epstein files tell a number of stories about the president. There are statements, photos, and flight logs about trips on Epstein's jet, about social overlap, about introductions, including a possible early connection to Melania Trump that echoes reporting by historian Andrew Lowney in his book about Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, entitled. Lowney alleged that Epstein helped facilitate introductions within elite circles. Melania has denied any such connections involving herself. After her lawyers sought retractions and apologies from others who made claims that Epstein introduced Melania to Trump, several passages referencing her were removed from both the UK and US editions of Lowney's book, and HarperCollins UK issued an apology to the First Lady. What remains in the public record are photographs of and familiar exchanges between Ghislaine Maxwell and Melania, including at least one email, in which Maxwell addresses her as Sweet Pea. Lucky for Trump, the height of his friendship with Epstein predates the reign of an email and predates the much more recent era in which he has expressed himself in private writing on digital channels, so we may never get a complete portrait of his personal communications. What we do have are FBI 302s and survivor depositions, testimony under oath that our system still treats as rumor. It's popular to say that Trump doesn't have values. It's also untrue. We know he values loyalty, for instance, and we know he values wealth. But what Trump values most of all is celebrity. He is preoccupied with star quality and concerned with those who possess it, that undefined but unmistakable factor that commands valuable attention. Trump knows that this, more than anything else, is what separates the winners from the losers, the ultimate binary through which he views the world and assesses his own place in it. Right now, it would seem that Epstein is up, while Trump has been left frantic and exasperated, unsure how to become the ultimate winner again. Epstein died in federal custody during Trump's first term. His death was ruled a suicide, and Trump's Justice Department confirmed the FBI investigations, supported that conclusion, and yet Epstein is still everywhere. To say that Epstein is haunting Trump from the grave doesn't quite go far enough. Epstein has effectively risen from the dead to dominate Trump's presidency and threaten his legacy. Trump can start wars, deploy troops, manufacture crises, but none of it shakes Epstein loose. No dog, Trump wags, barks loud enough. Epstein may be dead, but in Trump's White House, he's the one with the bone. This brings us to the end of our time together here on the Vanity Fair Hour. Once again, you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith, your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Thanks so much for tuning in. I invite you to join me next week for another full hour of stories from VanityFair.com. Thanks for listening, and have a great week, everybody.